Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Adam Ragusea, in for Anthony Brooks.
The decency of a nation is more determined by how we tolerate or do not tolerate the abuse of women, the abuse of anyone.
Vice President Joe Biden was at the University of New Hampshire in Durham this week, not talking up the campaign, but campaigning against sexual violence, and specifically sexual violence on college campuses. It's an issue that has been attracting a great deal of attention recently, particularly in the Northeast. Last week, Boston City Councilor Ayanna Pressley disclosed that when she was 19 and a student at Boston University, she was raped.
I am a survivor of sexual assault while a college student.
In another incident at the Massachusetts College of Art and Design, a student who was found to have fondled another student in her sleep was placed on probation and told to stay away from the victim. That's it, according to an investigation by the New England Center for Investigative Reporting. The victim complained to the U.S. Department of Education that the sanctions were inadequate, but the department determined the school did nothing wrong.
How colleges and universities respond, or don't, to sexual assaults on campus is crucial. It's an issue the Center for Public Integrity looked into last year in a joint investigative series with NPR. We're taking a look at it again today in today's Talker, because this week the federal government also issued new guidelines on how schools must deal with sexual assault on campus. Question is, are new guidelines enough, or will it take more to change attitudes and cultures both among students and college administration? Join us with your thoughts, stories, and experiences. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Well, joining us now from NPR in Washington is Gordon Witkin. He's managing editor for the Center for Public Integrity. Gordon Witkin, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me, Meghna.
It's great to have you today. Also joining us is Mary Mayhew. She's the director of SHARP, or Sexual Harassment and Rape Prevention Program, at the University of New Hampshire, where Vice President Biden gave his speech yesterday. Mary Mayhew, welcome to Radio Boston to you.
Thank you so much. And again, thank you for having me and talking about this wonderfully important topic.
Well, it's great to have both of you. Mary Mayhew, let me just start with you first. How prevalent, you know, for those people who didn't get a chance to read Gordon Witkin's great reporting from his staff last year, tell us, how prevalent is sexual assault on college campuses?
I mean, it was a great report. Thank you, Gordon, for that. But it's quite prevalent. I mean, the national statistics say about 1 in 5 women will be sexually assaulted during their time on college campus.
1 in 5?
1 in 5, yes.
And is that an accurate number, or is that an underreporting, you think?
Well, we all know, just not only on college campuses, but nationally and internationally, sexual assault is a vastly underreported number. At the University of New Hampshire, we actually do some prevalence studies that get at what we think are accurate numbers at the University of New Hampshire. But I haven't quite compared them to the one in five, but we do some significant studies to try to get accurate numbers.
Well, I mean, can you share some of those numbers with us? The prevalence, at least there, up in Durham.
Sure. Every 5 years, the University of New Hampshire does an unwanted sexual experience study. Some of the research colleagues at UNH, and 2006 was the latest data, and that number estimated, based on a pretty wide sampling, that 140 women will experience sexual assault, including penetration, with either force or threat of force. So that's a pretty significant number.
Wow. Okay, so that is the case at least at the University of New Hampshire. But as you said, 1 in 5, and I believe I've also read that up to 6% of men as well are victims of sexual assault while students at universities and colleges in the United States. Gordon Witkin, with the Center for Public Integrity, you guys took a very hard look at this issue of what happens after the assault and essentially how schools handle reports of sexual violence. What did you find?
We found that, first, that the policies were often not clear. We also found that the alleged victims of sexual violence felt that the process was both confusing and not particularly friendly. In the end, a lot of alleged victims felt as if they did not get justice, but just as importantly, the feeling that they were sort of victimized a second time, stigmatized, in many cases forced by conditions around what happened to leave school, while alleged perpetrators, even those found quote-unquote responsible in the college judiciary system, which is a finding of guilty essentially, that many of those perpetrators were allowed to stay on campus. So the victim ended up leaving more often than the perpetrator.
You know, Vice President Biden yesterday gave this kind of, I guess, stereotypical story as an example of oftentimes how these cases do get investigated and decided. You know, he mentioned, like, there's, you know, a woman is attacked on campus, and she decides to go through the school's disciplinary process instead of the police. But school investigators, again, this is his example, ask the young woman what she was wearing, if she was drinking, and if she was dancing. And based on her answers, they deem her not a credible witness. Case dismissed because the guy seemed nice. Is that something that you have, that you found, Gordon Witkin, that is typical in terms of how cases are handled sometimes on colleges and universities?
Well, I would not say typical. I'm sure the vice president was trying to make a point. That scenario is somewhat stereotypical. But those sorts of questions are asked and are part of an atmosphere that makes alleged victims feel like they're not being taken seriously, or they're not involved in a process where the adjudication is fair.
Mm-hmm. Listeners, we are talking about sexual assault on campus. Have you witnessed a sexual assault, or has it even happened to you? If so, what did you ask your college or university to do about it, if anything, and was that enough? And when we hear, as Mary Mayhew told us, that 1 in 5 women and up to 6% of men are attacked while in college, are new federal guidelines what we need to solve this problem, or do we need to do much, much more? Do we need to change the culture on college campuses around New England? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Mary Mayhew at the University of New Hampshire, pick up this point that that Gordon Witkin was talking about, that oftentimes the process that when someone is attacked and they may want to come to the university, it's quite confusing. So I guess why would a student want to come to the school rather than reporting directly to police?
Well, I think there's a variety of reasons why someone would want to report to their school. One of the things that a school or a college can offer is a much quicker solution. Oftentimes, the person who's been assaulted isn't looking to send somebody to jail. They're looking for a different kind of remedy. They may be looking for just to not have to see that person, to not have to run into them on campus. A positive solution for that person might be just they're no longer enrolled in that school, or they're no longer in the residence halls. A criminal justice process can take a year or two, and if there's not an arrest, there's no reason why that person can't contact them again, and they feel vulnerable and potentially re-traumatized. So schools can step in, and if they do it effectively, can do it quickly, can do it with a lower burden of proof, and so they can be a very effective remedy for students.
Gordon Witkin, but are they being an effective remedy? Because I remember listening to some of the reporting that you guys did jointly with NPR last year. Some of the problems was that, say, there were students on certain campuses who were serial rapists. They were known to have attacked people multiple times, and yet still nothing was done. So what is it that colleges and universities are actually required to do, you know, today before these new guidelines came out?
Well, I think the guidelines are a step in the right direction, but let's face it, the atmospherics around sexual harassment on college campuses, much of which sadly involves drinking, is a much larger issue. Vice President Biden went to the University of New Hampshire because the Durham campus is known for having rather clear procedures. As a matter of fact, we also found that Holy Cross had very clear procedures. Other schools do not. And it's often very confusing what needs to be done, or how a student who, after all, let's remember, is probably a 19 or 20-year-old who's been traumatized and may not be used to legalese, how they proceed is confusing. And again, in some ways, the most shocking part of this was how lenient the punishments were for those who were essentially found guilty.
Lenient? Give us some examples.
Well, we found cases in which a perpetrator who was essentially found guilty of a sexual assault, that's the responsible finding I was referring to, was mm-hmm. asked to apologize or write a term paper or asked...
Write a term paper?
Seriously, yes. And or, for instance, not come back for the summer semester when it was already clear that that perpetrator had no intention of attending the summer semester. So these were especially troubling cases, and victims continued to be traumatized by the lack of serious punishment, and that lack of serious punishment frequently resulted in the victim having to run into the perpetrator on campus, not every now and then, but all the time.
Gordon Witkin and Mary Mayhew, chime in on this, because there's one thing that just kind of confounds me or astounds me about this, is that if such attacks, assaults, happened one block away, not on the college campus, I presume that law enforcement by default would have to get involved if it were reported to them. Why is that? I guess up until, you know, this week when these new federal guidelines came out that says, you know, in part colleges and universities need to report these things, why is it that that wasn't a requirement before?
Gordon, would you like to go first or would you like me to?
Go ahead.
Well, at the University of New Hampshire, we actually have a police department on our campus, a real police department. So a student can go through conduct, can go through the police, and can do, or could choose both options. So they're not mutually exclusive, at least on our campus.
But it wasn't the default thing that you had to report, though, right?
No. And okay. One of the things, the University of New Hampshire, my program, actually, we have a crisis center on campus. So we provide direct services to survivors. They can come into our office, talk confidentially with a legally protected confidentiality statute. The student can say what happened to them, and we will sit down with them and talk through all the options mm-hmm. and all the repercussions so they can make informed choices about what, in fact, they want to do.
Mary Mayhew, I actually want to get into much more detail about what the special things that you're doing up there at UNH
sure.
in a few minutes. But Gordon Witkin, chime in on this, and then we got a ton of listeners who also want to join us. So,
well, what Mary's laying out are a clear set of procedures that were not in place on many college campuses. And in fairness, I would want to say that the applicable laws here, Title IX of the Education Amendments of 1972, the FERPA privacy laws, and the so-called Clery Act on reporting campus crimes of this nature, they're very confusing, and they've been amended a number of times. There's been guidance from the federal government in previous years that I think was pretty vague, and there have also been clear legal conflicts between the requirements of Title IX and the privacy protections afforded by FERPA. And I think this confusion was allowed to just sort of fester and sit there for quite a while. And in response to some of the controversy and we hope some of the coverage of this issue was in part what facilitated this much more detailed guidance that was offered this week by the Department of Education.
Mm, and that detailed guidance includes, as we mentioned, colleges and universities having to report to law enforcement when the cases come forward.
But it also makes, let me just interrupt for 1 second there. It also makes clear, which had not really been clear on a lot of college campuses, that the college was required by Title IX to conduct its own investigation regardless of what local law enforcement was doing.
We found
a lot of cases where college administrators were either complacent or confused and responded by saying, well, we don't want to get in the way of the criminal investigation. We have to let that run its course. And the Department of Education's guidance this week said, no, absolutely not. That has nothing to do with your requirement to move forward expeditiously.
Oh, interesting. And I see that also the guidelines include that schools now must have sex discrimination policies in place and an employee responsible for managing the institution's compliance with Title IX. Surprising that that wasn't there before. But we are talking about sexual assault on college campuses and what can and should be done about it. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Gordon and Mary, we have a lot of listeners who want to join us, so I want to bring their voices in here. Laura is calling from Somerville. You're on the air, Laura.
Hi. I was just calling to share my story. I'm an avid listener of NPR, and this came up and my heart sank as I was driving. My first day of college 4 years ago, I was raped in a fraternity house, and that is my virginity of that's how I lost my virginity. And I chose not to report it to the university for fear of being socially ostracized. I talked with a few people, you know, I told friends, and I had talked with, you know, an RA about actions to pursue, and ultimately decided not to do it because the person who did it was in the cool fraternity and I didn't want to be outcast. Well, in the long run, another sorority had found out about it, and I was not accepted because they didn't want someone who made up lies about their friends.
Wow.
And so it just, you know, it's, and in the long run, it was actually funny that I had classes with this individual, and he ended up living across the hall from my boyfriend for a year, so I saw him every single day. And when my boyfriend and I had finally broken up, he apologized to my boyfriend for his action and said, you know, if I had known you, I would have never done it, even though it's completely unrelated.
Wow.
And so I just think that it's funny that I never actually really told this many people before, but I think that, you know, regardless of whether it was forced or, you know, pressured, I think that this is something that girls, you know, an 18-year-old girl who's coming into college far away from home, face this a lot, unfortunately. And I just wanted to share my story that it is real.
Laura, thank you so much for the courage to call us and share your story. And I hope many people learn from what you experience and have to say. Thank you so much. Mary Mayhew, what do you hear when you hear someone like Laura speaking out about the fact that she had to live across the hall from the person who attacked her?
I mean, it's just all too familiar a story. And I'm so sorry that that happened to Laura. And really, it, because of stories like that at our school, I know we're going to talk about what we do at UNH, we actually created a campaign this year, a very powerful multimedia campaign, teaching friends how to support their friends. It's called Friends Believe Friends. When I hear her experience in the sorority, we have gone out on lots of different levels to teach people to believe their friends and to support their friends and how to stand by their friends in effective ways to help them through these really difficult times.
Mm. And Meghna, yeah. I'd ask that while that, I think from a layman's standpoint, may sound incredible, we heard many such stories. And my point here in backing up Mary is that the social ramifications and social stigma aspects of this, we found many young women who did not come forward for social reasons. My friends won't believe me. The person who did it is part of our existing social group, mm-hmm. so I don't know what's going to happen to me. It's going to be awkward, etc., etc. And that was stunning to me. But again, you if you haven't been in college in a while, you forget what sort of closed communities, small communities these are, and how important these sorts of social relationships are.
Yeah,
and it's easier to believe that you're making it. It's more comfortable for me to believe that you're making it up rather than to believe that somebody in my community, in my circle of friends, could do such a horrible thing.
And especially when that circle of friends is so important. I mean, as Laura said, so many students are away from home, and their former, you know, social supports, their family, are really far away. And so the people that surround you become that much more important and influential. You know, on that note, this gets us straight into this issue of the basic culture on college campuses, and how, you know, I've read, you know, some people call it the dirty little secret is that, as you both are saying, this happens. It's not that it's accepted, but people don't really want to talk about it because the problem is so deeply ingrained. And that brings us to this little piece of tape that I want to play. And I have to warn our listeners, it is sexually graphic because it has to do with a case that's ongoing at Yale University. This is some sound that we got off YouTube from the Yale Daily News. And it is a group of fraternity members on the Yale campus. They were pledges. They were chanting last year. And here's what they were actually chanting on the Yale campus. It was caught on video. Again, a warning to listeners. It is sexually graphic, but let's listen.
No means yes. Yes means Yale. No means yes. Yes means Yale. No means yes. Yes means Yale. No
I mean,
means
It's almost unbelievable that students would be standing outside dormitories chanting this as part of the pledge process. I mean, some Yale students filed a complaint with the Department of Education, the Civil Rights Office, under Title IX, saying the culture is the problem at Yale. That's an ongoing issue. But, you know, Gordon and Mary, when it's so deeply ingrained that you hear, you know, supposedly the cream of the crop students at Yale saying no means yes and yes means anal, what are you going to do about that?
Well, I think, as we alluded to earlier, you're right. It's a deeply ingrained cultural problem. And the other type of experience deeply ingrained in college, let's face it, is heavy drinking. And there's no doubt that this complicates trying to deal with this effectively. And trying to, I mean, in fairness to the schools, it is difficult trying to adjudicate these cases when so many of them involve hazy recollections, mm-hmm. and when in so many of these cases, both alleged perpetrator and alleged victim were severely drunk.
Actually, Mary, if you hang on for just a second, I want to come to you, but there are so many other listeners. We're going to run out of time. I want to get their stories in here, too. So let's go to Middleborough. Adam is on the line. Welcome to Radio Boston, Adam.
Hi, how are you?
Doing all right.
I just wanted to call in and share my story because, you know, I keep hearing you mention that alcohol is so often involved, and my personal experience actually happened in my own dorm room, and I was sleeping, and my roommate came in and was intoxicated, I don't believe just on alcohol, and he approached me while I was in bed and woke me up, and he, he never really pushed himself on me, but it was very uncomfortable, and he was practically nude, and I left the room immediately, and I went to, the campus police and the resident assistant, and the resident assistant almost couldn't keep a straight face when I was first telling the story, and the campus police were basically saying that there wasn't much that they could do, and then I went through about 2 weeks of hell trying to get a different dorm room or a different roommate or something, and I was told constantly by university authorities that there simply wasn't another room available, and there's nowhere to put him right now.
Wow.
And my thought was, well, how could you even allow him to stay here when, you know, he's been known for drug use and also has approached someone like this?
Wow.
And I stayed on friends' floors in apartments in Boston or even in other dorm rooms, but I made sure he didn't see me mm-hmm. if I was there. And I even ended up staying with a friend's grandmother for one weekend because my family was too far away for me to commute.
Adam, thank you so much for calling and sharing your story. And I want to, you know, use your story as an example to turn back to Mary Mayhew and say, UNH has been held up as an example of programs that are working in terms of doing really something proactive about sexual assault. So in the last, minute or so that we have here, can you walk us through what it is that you're actually doing up there that got the attention of Vice President Biden?
Well, I think we're approaching the subject on so many different levels. We do have a crisis center, so we actually can do direct service and network with all the systems on the campus to work on the problem in a way or the situation in a way that the survivor wants us to. That's one of our first and foremost. We also have ongoing education and outreach, trying to change the culture, talking about consent, talking about what a bystander is, just using social media, using traditional programming, we do that. In addition to that, though, we also have a really strong research practitioner relationship. There are folks at UNH, the Prevention Innovations team. We can say, we want to know something. Can you help us research it to make sure this is evidence-based and effective?
Mm-hmm.
And then we can take it back to the community. So we really try to approach it on lots of different levels, and we've really come at it from a victim-centered perspective because we are so tied in with our statewide coalition of providers. That's the bigger picture.
Well, and in the last minute that we have here, Gordon Witkin, we've got these new federal guidelines. It seems to be a start, but in your investigations that you've done, where would you recommend that colleges and universities look to next in order to do something about sexual assault on campus?
Well, I think the guidelines are one step. I think it's also crucial that the remedies and assistance available be made crystal clear to kids, probably in the orientation aspect of when they're first on campus, and that is abundantly clear, as it appears to be at the University of New Hampshire, exactly where you go to get help in this sort of situation on campus.
Well, Gordon Witkin, managing editor of the Center for Public Integrity, and the team that led, along with NPR, this wonderful investigative series last year about sexual assault on campus, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having us, Megan.
And Mary Mayhew, director of the Sexual Harassment and Rape Prevention Program at UNH in Durham, thank you so much for your time as well.
Thank you very much.
And listeners, you can always continue this conversation online at our website, radioboston.org. There's much more after the break. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Adam Ragusea today. This is Radio Boston.